Welcome to New York Society Library. I'm Carolyn Waters, the head librarian, and my only job here tonight is to welcome you and to tell you to please turn off your cell phones if you have any cell phones or any other devices that might disrupt the presentation. And also, you may have noticed we have books for sale, and I'm sure all of our panelists will be happy to sign them afterwards, so please take a look at that too. So now, without further ado, I want to introduce Laura Curtis. She's the president of the Mystery Writers of America New York chapter. And we're very excited to have you and all of the panelists here. We had a great program back in the fall, and we were so anxious to have you all back. So please welcome Laura Curtis and all the panelists.
Hi, I'm just going to take one brief minute of your time because I know you're all anxious to hear from the panel, and not from me. But a little bit about Mystery Writers of America, in case you don't know anything about the organization. Despite its name, it is not just for writers. It is also for anybody who really loves to read in the mystery genre, the crime fiction genre, anybody who wants to do research in the genre. We welcome all comers. And the New York chapter is also a bit of a misnomer because we actually cover six states. We cover New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and West Virginia. So we have a lot of members, which means we have a lot of expertise. And I do encourage you that if you have any questions at all about the organization or about anything that you would like us to help you with, or you think you might want to become a member, or you just want to hang out with mystery writers and come to our meetings, or anything like that, feel free to email me. My email address is president@mwany.org. And again, my name is Laura, and I will be happy to answer your questions. And now I'm going to turn this over to our moderator, Linda Ludrian, and she is going to introduce our panelists. And they're going to inundate you with wonders.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura, and the NWA and the New York Society Library for hosting and organizing this panel. And thank you for inviting me to moderate. So New York is, as we all know, is an incredibly vibrant city with a character of its own. It's a city of culture and cultures. Its energy draws people from all over who come to the city to make it in New York and end up making it their own. So tonight we have three authors who've written critically acclaimed mysteries set in New York, but they've also taken on the extra challenge of writing historical mysteries set in the city. So we'll have a chance to see the city through the writer's eyes and talk about the difficulties and the surprises they've encountered in their research and writing. The panel star in the center is Radha Vatsal, if I'm pronouncing that right, who grew up in Mumbai and came to the US as a teen to attend school. She has a PhD in English from Duke University and did her doctoral research on women in the silent movies. From which her interest in this period just before World War I grew, and that's the era in which her first book, A Front Page Affair, is set. It features intrepid reporter Kitty, as she's known in the book. And her next novel, Murder Between the Lines, comes out in a month, in May. And on my far left is Lindsay Faye, who came to New York in 2005 from the West Coast. She's an actress in addition to being a novelist. And she wrote a trilogy of novels set in 1845, featuring Timothy Wilde, who was one of the earliest police forces in the city. And in her first novel, The Gods of Gotham, he actually becomes New York City's first detective. That novel was a nominee for the Edgar Award for Best Novel, presented by Mystery Writers of America. And her other books are, in that trilogy, Semaphore Secret and Fatal Flame. And her latest novel, James Steele, not in the series, but is a finalist for the Edgar novel this year. And then also next month, she will come out with a collection of Sherlock Holmes stories called The Whole Art of Detection. And then closest to me is Stephanie Pintock, who's the author of two series that take place in New York. Her historical series features Detective Simon Zila, takes place in 1905. And that series, In the Shadow of Gotham, won an Edgar Award for best first novel in 2010. She's also has a thriller series set in contemporary New York with Hostage Taker and most recently City on the Edge. So welcome, everybody. So to start off with, I wanted to ask the panelists to comment on just a general question. How you came to pick your particular era and why you chose to set your books in New York City?
Okay, how's this go? Good? I like answering this question because I actually, it's much simpler for me to be able to deliver an answer to why I decided to set The Gods of Gotham in 1845 New York than it could be. It's not esoteric in any way. I always write books that are a book I want to read that doesn't exist. And so I think I would really like to read this book. But this book doesn't seem to exist yet. I've searched for it everywhere. I've tried to cross-reference it. I've asked for recommendations. It's just not around. What do I do? I love Caleb Carr type novels. I love the Alienist mystery novels that are really well researched, particularly ones that are set in New York. And I had lived in New York for several years at this point. I think I had lived in New York for 7 or 8 years when I started The Gods of Gotham. And I fascinated by New York, but I thought about how many books exist that have to do with police keeping in New York City and the romance and just the sort of infamy of the NYPD. The NYPD is known throughout the world. It's glamorized. It's for its corruption, for its chutzpah, for its background in Irish culture, for all sorts of things. You know, you think of gangs. New York, you think of all these cultural icons from all sorts of eras that have to do with New York City, and The Alienist is, of course, one of them. Now, that's Teddy Roosevelt era New York, that's the turn of the century. And I said to myself, what I would like to read right now is a novel that is about the very first New York City police officer. I want to read Day One, Cop One of the NYPD. I don't know when the NYPD was founded. When was it founded? I said to myself. So, when on earth was the NYPD founded? And I said, and what novel is based on this so I can go read that? And then I looked it up, and it turned out nobody had gotten around to doing that yet. And I said, okay, well, I have a clear task in front of me. Because it was actually 1845 when the NYPD was founded. And this is shocking, but we were already a city of 400,000 people before we had a police department. Before that, it was a system of night watch and constabulary and sheriffs and that sort of thing. The night watch were notoriously terrible. So the NYPD being founded in 1845 led me to research the year 1845, because I said, well, clearly the novel's being set in 1845, and people say, why is it set in 1845? Well, if the NYPD had been founded in 1872, then the Gods of Gotham would be set in 1872, but that's not what happened. In 1845, the police department was founded, and the same year, the Irish potato famine landed full force. This was the first year that really so many tens of thousands of Irish people were flocking to New York
So I came to the 1910s, which is when my novel is set, and it's the first in a series, through my work in silent cinema. I was watching silent movies from the teens, and I started to see that there was an explosion of films in this time, series films, with active women heroines doing things like, chasing down villains and fighting on top of moving trains and capturing the bad guy and running down mountains being like chased by boulders like Indiana Jones, but 7 years earlier. And this was all before women had the right to vote. And I said, I wonder, what's going on here? Because this wasn't just a few, these were multiple series from about 1912, 1913, all the way up to 1919. People estimate about 600 episodes in all. And so I said, this is very interesting. There were also very many women who directed and produced films at the time. And I started looking further into it, and I saw that just across the board, it seemed that women were very active in the professions, in academia. And sort of as my inquiries broadened even further, I started to realize, well, this is actually a very interesting time in US history where the country goes sort of from being Victorian at the turn of the century to by the time it reaches the 20s, it already looks modern. You have jazz and flappers and music, and everything has changed, and a whole series of changes, which kind of for me was crystallized in film, where during the teens people are watching shorts and then they have these new feature-length films come in and people are saying, will that medium even stick around? And it does stick around. And it all happens very fast during these World War I teen years. And like Lindsay said, I felt like there weren't too many novels out there that were light and entertaining but explored the U.S. during World War I from a domestic perspective. So I felt the stories were all about, battlefield stories or... and we think of it as Europe's war, but it was really the war during which the U.S. became sort of what it is in the modern United States that we recognize it to be. So I wanted to do a series that would take a young woman protagonist sort of from the beginning of World War I. So my first book is set in 1915, right after the sinking of the Lusitania, and it would... And the series would go in increments from 1915 all the way to 1920 when women get the right to vote. And of course, New York seemed like the perfect place to set it because so many of the historical events and things that happened actually took place in the city. And then the whole series, the second one comes out in May, so the rest of it is all still just in my mind. But it's based very clearly on historical events that happened in the city. Mostly they're not so well known.
So my answer to why New York is pretty simple. It's the city I know the best, and it's the city I love the best. And as long as I feel that way about it, it's probably where all my books are going to be set. There's so much going on here that's just rich fodder for writing. With both of my series, Contemporary and 1905, they both grew out of my fascination with criminal profiling. I have been obsessed with it probably since I read Silence of the Lambs and watching Criminal Minds, CSI, all that on TV. So with me, I think both series came following that interest. For the first series, it was almost a question like Lindsay had with her series. Well, how did this get started? I'm reading all about the latest science and forensics, but when did that really explode in New York City? It was right around the turn of the century. And that was when, based on novels that were happening in London, a few people in the NYPD, similar to my detective, Simon Zeal, started actually listening to what sociologists, criminologists had to say. What did they offer that could help them catch a killer? When I decided to try something modern, one of the things I did was to go to FBI school Major cities around the country, including New York, offer a course for people who want to learn more about their agents and what they do. So I did this. 10 weeks. I even got a graduation ceremony with Kathy on the phone. Very fun. But I'll never forget the idea that gave me the germ for my new series. It was, we were having a night session with someone from the tech division. Doing technological crime. And he flat out admitted that some of the most cutting edge work right now is being done not by the white hats, but by the black hats. And someone had the question, well, do you ever reach out? Do you ever get their help? He wouldn't answer. And that made me think of a story that had always stuck in my head looking back to the past of Eugene Vidocq. He was France's most notorious criminal. And what he was really famous for was not getting caught, but escaping. He was a master of disguise. No sooner would he be put in jail, he would escape and be on the lam again. And there was a point in his career that he was approaching middle age, he gets tired, and decides he would like a clean slate, a new start. So he walks into the head of the French police and says, I'd really like to make a deal. I can tell you things I know. You give me a clean slate, we're going to call it even. And the head of the French police said, well, it occurred to him that maybe sometimes you need a thief to catch a thief. So he said, I'd like you actually to come work for me. He did. He was so good at his job, he soon became head himself. And when he had the choice of putting together the men he wanted, the staff was most elite units, he didn't go into the right. Recruited from the firm class. And he was also somebody that we credit as being one of the very first criminal profilers, because he was the one who said about the system for organizing crime, criminals and their crimes. You know, what can you tell about the similar MOs and characteristics that they always rub at night, they always rub jewelry. He organized the fingerprinting. And I started to think about what that could look like today, putting that idea together with what that FBI agent had said. And I came up with my modern FBI VDOC unit. And of course, it had to be set in New York. Because if something like that happened today, it would have to be diverse. It would have to have all kinds of criminals with very unique skills, and I didn't think you could find it anywhere but here.
Lindsay, and that's one of the interesting things about the Timothy Wilde series is the thieves' journey, also called Flash. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that.
I would love to, but I always have this sort of hindbrain check when I start to talk about Flash, and I'm like, how far back do you need to go regarding Flash Potter? So Flash Potter is the dialect that was spoken by the criminal classes in mid-19th century New York City. Its roots, briefly, can be traced to the 1640s in Derbyshire. In the 1640s in Derbyshire, England, a group of criminals came up with a very clever idea where they said, look, if we invent an elaborate language that's all our own, and we're talking in pubs about our next heist, or our next, assassination attempt, or even just what we did last Tuesday, then any sort of authority figure who might be able to report on us, who happened to be listening in, wouldn't actually be able to understand what we're saying. This turned into a criminal jargon known as thieves' cant in England. And thieves' cant was pretty incomprehensible in some of its incarnations throughout the criminal classes. And when I say criminal classes, I mean that this was deliberately invented as a way to obfuscate your motives from the judiciary. But then, of course, you're not doing this in a vacuum and language is organic. So the people who are making up this slang jargon to get up to no good are also living in districts with people who simply don't have enough money to live elsewhere. But slang is very infectious, so the dialect starts spreading. class system was so stark in this time period, right? So we actually use flash powder all the time. Like, if I were to tell you that someone had kicked the bucket, you would know what I meant, right? You know what kick the bucket actually means, though. Well, it meant that you were about to be hanged, and that a bucket would be kicked out from underneath you. So kick the bucket is flash powder, but you don't necessarily, when you're using flash powder, know that you're doing it at all. So this is something that has remained in the English language throughout history. We use it all the time, and we just don't even know it. We just say these things without realizing what they mean. But during the time period that I'm writing, the very first police officers in 1845, George Washington Matzel was the name of the first New York City chief of police. And he realized that his copper stars, as they were called, had absolutely no idea what half of the stuff that was coming out of the people, they would arrest people, half the stuff that was coming out of their mouths, they had no idea what kind of confessions they were taking. They really couldn't communicate with them if the folks who were, you know, being listened to, if they had any desire to keep information from the coppers, as they would have been called, then all they had to do was duck into flash powder and the cops wouldn't understand them. So George Washington Matzel realized that this was a problem, and he was this very intellectually omnivorous person in addition to being someone who was like brutishly large and like a fascinating gentleman, studied criminology during a time period when criminology really wasn't even a word. It wasn't something that would have been studied. He wanted to know how gangs formed. He wanted to know about this language. He wanted to know about all sorts of things. So he decided he was going to sit down and solve this problem by writing a dictionary. So he did. He sat down and he said, I'm going to compile all of the flash powder that I can come up with. I'm going to give clear definitions of it. I'm going to provide it to my copper stars. And the Star Police were founded in 1845. He didn't actually publish his dictionary until 1857 because this became increasingly a problem, and then he was working on it throughout. But he decided to call his dictionary Vocabulum, or the Rogue's Lexicon, which is like the coolest name for any academic work ever to happen, Vocabulum or the Rogue's Lexicon. So like, this is easily accessible because you have a lot of these cheap paperbacks that are being made now of volumes that have gone out of copyright. And I was doing research into the copper stars. I discovered that George Washington Matzel existed, the police chief. I did a bunch of research into him. I realized he'd written this book, and then I realized there was an entire language that these people spoke in during the time period. So The Gods of Gotham and its two sequels are partly written in flash powder, and there are dictionaries at the beginning of each of these works of fiction that are called directly from George Washington Matzel's dictionary. Now, the tricky part of this was that I had a dictionary. I didn't know the syntax. So the syntax is fine. But the dictionary and the definitions, and so, you know, maybe I'm getting wrong some of the ways people use this language, and maybe some of the tenses and so forth. The syntax could be completely off. I have no idea. I don't have a record of it. But I had the dictionary. So
the dictionary that George Matzel put together is something that people can find today?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can order it online and get a paperback copy of it. You could also go to books.google.com, and if you go to books.google.com, you enter Vocabulum, Rogue's Lexicon, or you enter George Washington Matzel, and you go to free Google eBooks, you could simply read through it anytime you wanted to see it, and you would find a lot of terms that are actually quite familiar.
So I wanted to ask the same question to Stephanie and Rada about, you know, how you write dialogue in a historical context, and sort of the trade-off that, like Lindsay talked about, you know, making up your, using your own syntax with words, and some of the things that you encountered writing historicals.
So it's an interesting question, writing dialogue in historical fiction. My protagonist is a young woman, she's 19, she's very sheltered, she goes to boarding school, and she generally moves about with a very sort of nice class of people, and I just felt a little concerned that the dialogue would start getting really coy and really prim because she's going to, you know, talk and think in a certain way. And so what I sort of decided to do was to not, in terms of dialogue, I mean, the novels are scrupulously researched, and they, I think we have questions about newspapers and stuff, so I'll talk about that later now, but really it's like each day of the novel follows a date, specific date in history, and it doesn't go ahead of that, and so it's like all like super accurate in that way. But in terms of the dialogue, I felt like I didn't want it to sound just sort of like prim, especially because she's kind of young, and so I decided to keep it as I don't have any anachronisms in the way she speaks, but I tried to keep it as kind of straightforward sounding as possible, so that there wasn't some sort of distance built up between the reader and the main character, especially. And I found like in the subsequent books, I don't use any words that would have been, or not as far as I know, any words or expressions that were in use like later, but. So I don't use anachronistic words and phrases, but I try to keep her way of talking a little bit more casual and a little bit closer to what we would be used now. Otherwise, I just felt it would get very formal and stilted, for particularly given the age of the protagonist and her shelter and kind of background. So.
For me, with modern dialogue, one of the things I do is eavesdrop a lot and watch a lot and observe how people talk, try to develop the ear for it. And it's really no different for historical, it's just that the medium is a bit different. We're lucky, all of us, that we have newspapers, we have contemporary literature. I certainly looked a lot at Dreiser and Edith Wharton when I was writing the 1905 series. One thing I did that might have been a little more unique, and again, it was simply to try to get the ear for how especially different classes of people would talk, is I went through trial transcripts. Because unlike the newspapers, which would be heavily edited, or even a novel of the time that reflects that writer's view of it all, with the trial transcripts, you actually kind of got the down and dirty how people really answered questions when they were talking in an everyday, you know, more of a purpose-based kind of setting. So that was one thing that helped.
Stephanie, in your series, you have your character Alistair Sinclair, who's, as you mentioned, a early practitioner of criminology. And I also want to say forensic psychology. I know that might, that narrows down when he does too much. But in my recollection of the novel, people are really resistant to that right at first. And so I wondered if you could talk about kind of the state of thinking at that time about criminology.
Sure. It was generally the outgrowth of science. And people who in the 19th century had been really working to learn, you know, a lot about how is a criminal made? You know, questions, are they born? Is it nature or nurture? Some criminologists had the idea that you could tell a criminal from the shape of his eyes or the shape of his nose. There were a lot of theories going around, and some of them were a little ridiculous. My favorite ridiculous ones was that, you know, maybe the retina of the eye would capture the image of the murderer. That was the last thing that they thought. So, you know, people were experimenting and they were trying. And because some of the ideas were outlandish and seemed ridiculous, the ones that were more solid had trouble gaining ground. But I think the movement that helped, and that certainly helped a criminologist like my Alistair Sinclair, was the willingness of people in different disciplines to talk to each other and to share knowledge. And that's what you see happening around the turn of the century for the first time. So that the body of knowledge that the psychologists had been collecting for the last few decades, suddenly they're talking with the sociologists and the police and trying to figure out, well, what can hold do to help us, you know, fight crime on the streets. And I think most people were very much like Detective Simon Zeal. They were open to it the minute they saw that it actually worked. And it wasn't all smoke and mirrors.
So just as a follow-up to Lindsay and Radha, is there's frequently things that come up in historicals that are really familiar to the reader, but are new and strange to your character. So I just wondered if how it was for you to kind of treat that in your writing, and how you maybe controlled yourself.
It's tricky to describe something that we sort of understand in a certain way, but actually happened in the past in a different way, and without sort of editorializing too much. So for instance, for me, one of the things, there's several things, but one of the things is that the protagonist wants to be a journalist. And women weren't allowed to work in the newsroom of a newspaper. They were basically usually confined to women's departments of the paper. Sometimes something, this character works for the ladies' page of a paper, which was like a special page for news that was supposed to be of interest to women. So it's no hard news at all. And so the way I kind of did that was tried to really dramatize it, where they were really, the staffs were also like kept apart, so I tried to dramatize it by putting the ladies' page of the newspaper on the third floor of the newspaper building, and it's past what they called the hen coop, which was where all the women typists sat. And then the newsroom is on the sixth floor. It's a different floor, and many times women weren't even allowed to set foot into the newsroom, so I kind of tried to dramatize that by having them actually be behind a glass wall, and the men have to come out whenever the women want to sort of ask a question. So really tried to dramatize this dynamic, which people at the time would have taken for granted. Another instance is, though, like, the main character, Kitty, she's 19, and she loves watching these silent-era film serials, Perils of Pauline, Exploits of Elaine, those are some of the titles. But the experience of watching a movie back in the teens was very different than it was now. For starters, films were shown as part of a program, and so you would have like a serial, you would have a short, you would have some slides, you would have all kinds of different things going on. And you could walk in and out at any time because there's no start time. So you just bought your ticket, you could sit, you could talk, because there's no, I mean, there may be someone playing the piano, but there's no dialogue to listen to, they're all silent. So it's a very different experience. And what I did basically was, instead of explaining that, try to dramatize the experience of what it might have been like for her to watch a movie, so that when the reader is reading, they can sort of infer. But if I would have just said she went to watch the movie or something, you would assume that the experience of watching a movie was what our experience of watching a movie today is, where, you know, start and end times and so on. So those are just two examples.
I think I did something similar in the sense that, you know, if you're thinking about the question, there are certain forensic things that we almost take for granted today that we shouldn't, in fact, take for granted. For instance, we should not take for granted that every DNA strand of evidence is going to be tested. People do not have the resources in a lot of forensic, you know, departments to immediately test and, like, oh, I automatically know what this, whose DNA this belongs to. It took me about 10 minutes and I cracked it. That's something that you might see on television, but it's not something that happens in every police department. But, you know, that sort of thing is so far away from the world of 1845 that what I largely did was I took skill sets that and you know, technologies that we would have today, and incorporating the Sherlock Holmes mysteries are an example of somebody doing something completely different. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was actually with Sherlock Holmes coming up with technologies that weren't being used widely in forensics at the time period. Sherlock Holmes comes up with an infallible test for whether something is a blood stain when we very first meet him in a study in Scarlet. He uses fingerprinting before Scotland Yard uses fingerprinting. He can tell footmarks apart, and he can tell bicycle tire treads apart. I didn't do that with Timothy Wilde. actually, what I did instead was make him a bartender. So Timothy Wilde has a whole other skill set entirely, because I promise you that I worked in hospitality for about 10 years, and my husband's a bartender, and my best friend's a bartender, and many of my other friends are bartenders.
Hmm.
And I promise you that your bartender knows everything about you. Your bartender does not need to test ink. Your bartender does not need to take your fingerprint. Your bartender does not need to administer a breathalyzer. Your bartender doesn't need to do anything technological. Your bartender knows exactly what you have been up to for the last 24 hours. And there's such a thing as people being extraordinarily observant of human nature, and that is what is key, I think, to the character of Timothy Wilde and to those particular mysteries. Because when I was reading up on, it's very hard to find first-person accounts of the early NYPD. It's almost impossible, but there was a fellow by the name of Bell, and he has a diary, and the handwriting is bloody excruciating. But it is at the New York Historical Society, and he talks about his sort of daily life as a roundsman. He was a roundsman Copper Star, which meant, you know, he was on patrol and the things he encounters. And he encounters things from, it ranges from, okay, so that swamp over on Warren Street is full again and a horse drowned and no one's getting rid of it. And like yesterday, six kids fell in. Like, terrible things that are just municipal things that have nothing to do with crime solving. But when he sets about solving a crime, it's all about community. And it's all about who he talks to. And it's all about, okay, well, this coat was stolen. And it's a kind of distinctive coat. But if you change the buttons on the coat, and then these buttons are missing over here. And so what he's doing is he's talking to everybody. And he's talking to the people who own what was called a Jerry shop, so a pawn shop. He's talking to all of the people that he can be in contact with who might have any information for him. And he's reading them on a really professional level in the sense that he's an expert interviewer. And he's very, very good at listening. And I think that instead of culling from any sort of emerging technologies happening, because they really weren't happening in 1845 yet, what Timothy Wilde is able to do is to take a wide range of information from a wide number of witnesses, have a lot of human instinct about who's telling him the truth and who's not telling him the truth, and then draw his own conclusions about holes and stories he's being told because of his career at Sandy Bar, because he's very observant regarding just human nature at large. And I think that still to this day, you could probably say that despite all of our advances in ways that we can track people with cell phones, with computers, with all of the other advances that we've made, I think that still gathering evidential human information is still really important. So I just sort of focused on that aspect of it instead of on the instead of on things that would have been anachronisms at the time.
So it seems to me it's impossible to write about New York without talking about class. And Rava, in your book, The Front Page Affair, your heroine is kind of in between, sort of an outsider, but very comfortable with the upper classes. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about some of these specific issues that came up in your novel.
Sure. So I thought about actually the issues of class a lot in terms of my heroine, because I wanted to have her be a character. First of all, I always thought of it as a serious character, so I wanted her to have a certain amount of flexibility. And she was going to start off, she's wealthy, and which allows her to do certain things. It gives her some kind of an education. She has ability with languages and ability to speak to different people. She has her car, she can drive, she has a certain amount of freedom. And also, as a woman, I thought it would be very interesting to do it that way, because there was a lot of pressure against women who worked when they didn't have to work. So it was one thing to work if you were a working woman and you really needed the money. It was another thing to actually choose to work. And so this young woman chooses to work, and she gets a lot of flack for that. But sort of in deciding where to put her on the class ladder, I had you know, initially I had thought of her being sort of old money East Side New York, and then I thought actually it would be more interesting to put her on the West, on West End Avenue, where her dad is sort of wealthy but nouveau riche, and they're living in an apartment, a very nice apartment that we would probably all love to live in these days. And she has a friend who lives on the East Side whose family is old New York money, who moved up from downtown, but as the city moved up from downtown, and so they have a lot of social standing, maybe not as much money, and who lives on the East and whose family looks down on this young woman who lives on the West Side, but who has an amount of freedom and things that the girl on the East doesn't. But she then goes to work in this ladies' page of a newspaper, and she's hired in the first place because her boss thinks that she's able to get into all the best drawing rooms. They're sent out to cover parties and so on, so she wants to have someone who can attend the parties at the country clubs and talk to people there. So she gets hired, but there are other women that she's surrounded with who work in the newsroom, I mean not in the newsroom, in the typist pool, and those are young women who have to work for a living. So I felt like I sort of thought of Kitty as fitting in as this like Upper West Side girl, like in a sort of milieu of professionals, as opposed to people who didn't have to work or had family money to lean on. And she kind of navigates the system, you know, given her shortcomings. And I think her shortcomings and her field of vision broadens as the novel proceeds and will continue to broaden as the series progresses. But I also think it's kind of fun to play against what she would know and what she wouldn't know, and what someone from a higher class that's socially higher than her, what kind of baggage that person would bring, what kind of baggage a person who's working in the as a typist would bring. So I thought those kind of things are fun to play against, and I think I do a lot of that in the novel. But I do feel like it's important to pay attention to class at the time.
So building on that kind of
panel,
I also just wondered, what other some of the broader social issues that both in the city and maybe the country as a whole that you feel is important to understand the context of your novels?
How long do we have?
I can say that throughout the Timothy Wilde trilogy, immigration is certainly an enormous concern. Like I said, the Irish potato famine happened the same year that the NYPD was formed. Irish were flooding into the city, and the Republican Party did not exist. It would not exist for years. You had the Whig Party, and the Whig Party was very concerned with banking and with tariffs, and they had a lot of financial ideas that they were putting forward. They really wanted nothing to do with Irish votes. They thought that was a very, very unseemly idea. What you have during this time period is the rise of the Democratic Party in all of its Tammany Hall glory, which was just thuggish as all get out, at the same time that it was so egalitarian. So it's very, very interesting to look at this voting process during the time period. Because, of course, Tammany Hall is rampantly corrupt, right? You have people
because Lieutenant Hall of the Democratic Party was that they said, okay, you vote for us, give us your loyalty, and we will give you social services. We will find you a job. We will give you food before you have a job. You can come down to the fire station. That was like a major social greeting place, and like we will have hot stew sundaes, and we will have dances, and we will have potlucks, and we will take care of you to the extent that you exchange that for voting for us. While the Whig Party was, you know, like talking a lot more about what the sort of interest rates ought to be, and that was not a concern to people who were just, you know, arriving here. And then you have the Irish who have this immense loyalty toward the Democratic Party versus the Whig Party because of the fact that they were absolutely penniless and destitute when they arrived, and this was really their only way of integrating themselves into New York society, which is why still today you see a very, very high percentage of New York City firefighters and police officers who have Irish heritage, which is amazing. It's very entrenched in this. So I think that when I was writing The Gods of Gotham specifically, and you know, it's an issue throughout the trilogy, but how we think about immigration, how we think about people who arrive on our shores, and how we think about how to take care of them, and whether or not we welcome them, I think is very important to this series, because I can certainly say that I sit here today with about half Irish heritage. And so that's a good chunk of my background. So the way I talk about immigration today has a lot to do with how I think about it historically and how we've gone through these cycles of people arriving here and what to do when they do arrive here, and how to be compassionate and how to be empathetic and how to be open to that happening. So I think that that's a major theme, absolutely, at least in Gods of Gotham and those other examples in that series.
I think for me, I'm always interested in approaching issues through character. How does the character whose viewpoint I'm writing through at the time approach it? Why is it important to him or her? With my first series, for Simon Zeal, he has a friend from his childhood who has joined the anarchist movement. It's heavily into radical anarchy. That makes it personal for him. As it was a big deal in 1905, but it wouldn't even have interested me as a writer if it didn't interest my character, if he wasn't trying to figure out what his friend was doing, what was he standing for, how does it relate to the crime at hand. Simon Zeal is also in love with a woman who is several social classes above him. In the 1905 world, that's not going to work out so easy. It's personal to him. In my latest book that came out in November, one of the members of my rogue FBI unit of ex-cons is guilty of being black in the wrong place at the wrong time. And when he is arrested, he experiences that double bind of being law enforcement himself and completely understanding what it's like to want to go home safe at the end of the night, but at the same time feeling targeted because of the color of his skin. So those are the ways that I've tried to navigate that as a writer, make it interesting to the reader, and ways that interest me.
So in your novels, and particularly the first one, a lot of the backstory has to do with the gambling dens in the Lower East Side and on the mansions of the city's elite. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what that was like.
Sure. I was writing a scene that was set in early winter. And as all of you know, in early winter in New York, we were much more likely to get rain than snow. My editor wrote a little note in the margin. Do you think it could snow? I think the snow would be really nice at this point. And I understood exactly what she meant. Because when you're creating this world for the reader, it's a mix of what's real and a little bit of the mix of the fantasy and where the reader wants to go. How do you make it a little bit more magical and interesting for them? And you want to be accurate, which I think I am with Alistair Sinclair. He's one of New York's moneyed elites. He's going to be invited to every party that Mr. and Mrs. Astor ever hosts. And Simon Zeal is scrappy and street smart from the Lower East Side, and he's very much at home in those gambling dens. And I think when we read about 1905 New York, yes, we want to know the details, we want to know the mundane, we want to know when it rains, but we also want to know the special things, the magical things that we associate with the extremes of the city.
So, and one follow-up to that, sense of place in your current series, where you take on St. Patrick's Cathedral and Macy's Thanksgiving Parade as a special event. So I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure. You know, again, it's part of the New York that everyone knows a little bit about, right? These big iconic places. So I set my hostage taking at St. Patrick's Cathedral in part because I think it plays such a huge role in the city. And especially on the date that I set the hostage taking, which is the night of the tree lighting at Rockefeller Center. And I actually only braved that one myself once because I don't do all the crowds. But, you know, it's magical. It's New York. Almost everyone who's come here as a tourist has been there and they feel they have a connection to it. But then, of course, you do the research, and I talk to the people who are on staff at St. Patrick's, and I learn about the secret tunnels and the window that's upstairs where the firefighters have gone to check it as part of their annual inspection. And the firefighters who had come and had written their names and date right before they lost their lives on 9/11, they have never washed that window. You still see the handwriting of those firefighters. It's a place that is loaded with history that we might not know, that I try to work into the book. But it's accessible because we've all been there. And the same thing for Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. It's something that I think we all know from our living rooms. We all have that immediate New York connection to. And one of the things that I tried to add to make it my New York and offer a different window to the New York. So, you know, as New Yorkers, we know that the parade actually starts the night before when the balloons are inflated by the Natural History Museum. And that's where I started my book. The police commissioner's daughter is there, and that's where she's kidnapped, and the action of this really begins. But that's kind of a magical slice of that parade that not everybody who isn't from here knows about. So it's that mix of the two that I think can appeal to these books about New York, both familiar and unfamiliar.
Close to the end of our hour. Is that the message? So, if there's any questions from the audience that you would like to ask our panelists?
Yeah,
you mentioned the reader thinking. Who are your readers?
Who are your readers?
Yeah, like, well, are you thinking of your readers writing, like, is it other particular people that you're writing for, or can you imagine a particular reader?
For me in particular, I imagine my mother-in-law. Because she is actually the ideal reader in my mind. She is a member of about 8 different book clubs, with 80 closest friends. She reads widely, she reads broadly, she enjoys everything. She likes history, she likes mystery, she likes thrillers. She loves memoirs. If it's well written, she loves it. And that would be my ideal reader. I'm always thinking, what's an appeal to her? What's an appeal to her book clubs? What do they talk about what do they want to know. But I think the flip side of that is that the ultimate reader is me. And what is the kind of book I would like to read? I will approaching the story that I'm trying to create, you know, what do I want to know? What kind of journey do I want to be taken on?
If I could just comment on what you just said, Stephanie, because I think that that's brilliant. But at a certain level, you have to be the reader who is the first litmus test, because it takes an extraordinary amount of time and effort to sit down and get through the process of writing a novel, any kind of novel, and a historical novel as well. And if you're not doing it from a place of your own experiences and your own passion, I think, and the things that you are most intellectually interested in and the things that you are most emotionally resonate with you as a person, if you're not telling some of your own truth while you're writing that book, no matter whose perspective it comes from, then it might as well be written by somebody else. And there would be no real reason for you to sit down and, I think, tackle it in the first place. So it's actually a really great question, because I think that there has to be that level of core emotional truth when you're writing a book where it has to interest you. You can't just set out and be like, okay, so vampires are big. I'm going to make some cheddar. Vampires are big right now. You can't just sit down and be like, okay, this is what I'm going to do, because it is of the moment. By the time you say that, that moment has already passed, because that person already had that passion and that person already wrote the book they wanted. So that's a really interesting question.
Yes.
I'd
like to know about how you differ in your writing process.
I guess I can just speak to how I write. I write at home. Yeah, while my kids are at school. And I outline pretty much, because I do a lot of research. I spend a lot of time actually reading the newspaper to determine the exact moment when the story is going to be set. So each of the books are set in a very specific short time frame that has like a start date, and I know the date and the day and what happened on that day and what happened a week before, and they go through day by day, and I don't skip a day, and I know what happened after. So basically, as I'm sort of figuring out exactly the moment to put the book, I've read the newspapers for about 3 months, I would say, in that time frame, and I kind of have all the headlines in front of me, and I have a calendar, and that's kind of what I use for plotting, but then I write. But I have a calendar that sort of refers to the days and dates of when the novel starts and what happened in history on those days and dates that are relevant to the story, and then I kind of weave the story in. But I write at home on a laptop, preferably in my pajamas. I don't have to drop someone off to school, and that's how.
Like Rada, I extensively go through the newspapers of the time period. I don't have them regimented day to day. That sounds like an amazing system. But I do have 6 months of research I do before I start writing. That's generally at Bryant Park or the New York Historical Society or other libraries, or sometimes occasionally from home, but often at the library. I don't outline, but I tend to have what I call tent poles. So if you're raising a circus tent, you tend to have poles where you think to yourself, okay, well, I know this is here, and I know this other one is here, and I know this happens, and I know this other thing happens. So I tend to have 5 or 6 moments throughout, including the major plot twist, that I know that happens, and then I write I fill in the blanks between those spaces. I do get dressed, but I would rather not. I do put on jeans and socks. I write from about 5 in the evening. My husband and I set up as a bartender with my 2 cats till about 3 in the morning when he gets home. And when he's not working, then I work during the afternoon. But I don't have a set writing schedule. I write as much as I can every single day that I can write. So
as frequently as I possibly can, just to keep the momentum going.
I don't write at home generally. I try to go to a coffee shop. We were talking about this before. And it's because, for me anyway, just the process of having to block out all the conversations around me and all the noise actually focus better on what's in front of my computer screen. I find it helpful. I had a really different writing process for my historical and my contemporary books. For historical, I think I was very similar to Lindsay. I had these sort of tent poles, but I gave myself a lot of freedom with how I would get from each major plot point to each major plot point, and I didn't do an extensive outline. The thrillers are different. They're designed to be read pretty much all in one sitting, maybe two. So the speed is much more lightning fast. You have a lot more of those roller coaster twists and turns. And I can't manage it as a writer unless I do a very extensive outline so that I really plan them and seated them in. And in terms of timing, I don't think so much in terms of time now as I do in terms of workout. You know, depending on where I am in terms of my contract due date. you know,
yeah,
either, yeah. it's either, you know, I'm aiming for 1,000 words a day. 1,500 words a day are very ambitious. It's a 2,000 word day. And if the writing is going really well, I might hit my target in 4 hours, which is good for that day. Other days don't go as well. I'm fucking
Stephanie, I have a record. I just want to tell you what my record is. Okay, so like normally, 1,000 words, I'm like, pat myself, like, I once wrote 6,000 words in one day.
Whoa.
I just wanted to make wow. But like, I was like crying by the end of it. I didn't see anymore. Like, I was really hungry. I don't know how that happened. It's never going to be repeated. That's why I'm telling you that I did that, because I'm never going to manage it.
My record is 4, so you win.
4 is a ton.
4 is a ton.
That's a ton.
That was like right on the
Your latest book is nominated for an Edgar for Best Novel. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How in the world did you come up with Jane Steele?
Goodness. Okay, so Jane Steele, which I believe is available.
Yeah, it's for sale.
Just yonder. Is a story that basically, the elevator pitch for it is, it's Jane Eyre meets darkly dreaming Dexter, essentially. It begins with the sentence, of all my many murders committed for love and for better reasons, the first is the most important. And the end of the introduction, which is, you know, like a little 3-page intro, is, reader, I murdered him. So it's essentially a riff off of Jane Eyre. Jane Steele is not Jane Eyre. Jane Steele is a woman who is a contemporary of when the book was published. So she's reading Jane Eyre in real time, and has experienced many, many parallels to Jane Eyre's life. She was she had a cruel childhood with a terrible cousin, and an aunt who hated her. She had a terrible boarding school experience with a vicious headmaster. The difference between Jane Steele and Jane Eyre is that terrible bratty little cousin ends up at the bottom of a ravine. And I'm not giving too much away here, because that's the first chapter, and the headmaster, you know, a few chapters later, who you just really wanted to wring his neck in Jane Eyre, he doesn't come to a very good end either. So it was based on the question, I was reading Jane Eyre again, because I love Jane Eyre, and I thought to myself suddenly, well, it's very odd that this small child is talking back to all these adults and saying, no, I'm actually a wonderfully moral person. I am morally upright, and you're wrong. And it struck me as just precocious and bizarre that any child would actually do that in real life. Most children are very sensitive to things that adults have to say about them. And so the question I asked myself, what if she was told by her adult guardians, you're wicked, you're irredeemable, you're devil-ridden, you're going to hell, and what if she said,
okay. In that case, if that's all true, then screw it. I guess it's carte blanche from here on out. And it also explores, I think, really deeply the idea of when is doing something that is technically immoral actually the most moral choice you could possibly make? When is doing the wrong thing the right thing? We all know that murder is wrong, but if your young cousin, in the case of the very first chapter, attacks you physically, and if it's in self-defense, is it wrong to defend yourself? Is it wrong to lash out physically in defense of somebody you love? When is it okay to lash out physically in defense of somebody you love if you're in a boarding school situation and somebody is, you know, starving your friend to death? When is it okay for you to retaliate if the entire circumstance of the moral conundrum is inherently unfair, patriarchal, and oppressive? So that's Jane too. That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you began and developed your relationships with your publishers?
Through an agent. So do you want to know how you found me? I mean, is it,
yeah,
is it from like
whatever
a publishing?
Whatever your story is.
Oh, well, it's a long story, but I think like a lot of people, I have a book that never was published that's sitting in a drawer, and I finished this book, and I can't remember, like several years ago, and I was getting ready to send it out to agents, and I sent it to a friend in England, and she loved it, and you know, just preliminary to sending it out to agents, I sent it to her to check out, and she loved it, and she's a writer, and she sent it to her agency in England, and the person over there loved it, and an agent there loved it, and they said, I'd love to represent you, and it was a big British agency, so they did sales in the US, and I said, sure, and phew, you know, I don't have to look for an agent, this is great, and so that was easy, and they did a huge, like, push. They tried to sell it in the US, sent it to a lot of places, and he didn't manage to do it. And that's something that taught me, because I felt like the book needed revision, and I asked him, did he feel like it needed revision? The agent said, no, he didn't think it needed revision. And I was like, all right, you know better than I do, go ahead. And so he did this big submission, and it didn't sell. And it's actually, like, in a way, it's a prequel to the first novel in the series. It's the same character, same everything, set in 1914 instead of 1915. But I kind of thought, okay, I've gotten so far. I really wrote in a vacuum. I really kind of isolated myself from the industry. I never joined NWA. I never did anything. I didn't meet other writers. You know, I just said, I want to write what I want to write and see what happens. And I said, that wasn't too bad for someone who just sat and wrote without sort of knowing anything called, I got this far, I'll give myself one more chance and see if I can do better next time. So I wrote the second novel, and then I decided, another friend who is actually in the industry said, you really need to find a US novel to sell your novel in the US. And so I did basically the same kind of thing that I suppose a lot of people do, which is that I, you know, looked up people, I saw the kind of work they represented. And the one thing that I think I got that was really helpful advice, I'm an academic, so we're trained to make unlikely connections. So I see my book and it says, it looks like this, and it looks like that, and you know, it looks like 500 other books to me, which probably the industry wouldn't see the similarities in the connection I was making. And then someone gave me the advice, like, look at your protagonist, you know, because I said, do I go with an agent who, like, who's represented novels about old New York, you know, like, on what basis do you find the similarities? They said, no, look at your protagonist, try to go for someone who's doing female historical fiction, and that's how I got my first agent, who then sold the series. Now I'm working with someone else, but that's how I got my start, and that's how I got through to the publisher. Right.
Thank you.
When I wrote my first novel, is a Sherlock Holmes pastiche. that was written out of an act of enormous hubris, because I love Sherlock Holmes, and I've loved him since I was like 10, so I wanted to see Sherlock Holmes solve the Jack River murders in a really, really gritty way, in a Caleb Carr way, not in a, okay, also there are Freemasons, and also there are vampires, and also there's the royal family, and also there's a Transylvanian cult, and also there's space aliens going to show up, and also et cetera, et cetera, and there's slime. I was like, what if there's just a serial killer in Sherlock Holmes? And I tried to make it as realistic as possible. When I finished it, I was astounded. I did 7 drafts of it before anybody ever saw it, and then I did a lot of very careful drafts of what's called a query letter that you send out to agencies, and I sent a bunch of queries out, and I was just incredibly lucky. That's fairly high concept. I was also extremely careful to polish the manuscript into this the best thing I could possibly make it. I read it out loud. I cut 10% of it. I did an entire draft getting rid of passive voice and adverbs. Like, I went bananas on this thing. And the same thing with the query letter. And I ended up getting a very reputable agent who sold it to Simon & Schuster. I was incredibly lucky. I then wrote 2 more novels that were my own original characters, neither of which sold, that still exist. I needed the practice. And then the next novel that I ended up selling was The Gods of Gotham, that was nominated for an Emmy Award. And The Gods of Gotham was with another agency, because my initial agency, we figured out that even though we liked each other very, very much, and worked together very well, we didn't, in fact, like the same books. So we had no frame of reference when we were talking to each other, which was unfortunate. So I also have gone through incarnations of publishers and of agents, but I think that what got me started on the path to actual publication was that I was obsessive and ruthless in the editorial process, not in the, I finished this, now where do I find a publicist to hire? It was, I finished this, now I'm going to spend quite some time trying to take this, you know, like, I like the saying that, you know, like a sculptor finds a perfect stone, and then they take that stone and then they make a statue out of it. An author actually has to create the stone out of thin air first, and then they have to make the sculpture out of it. And so that's not an easy process, and I think that that's very important for anybody who's aspiring to, you know, get their work out there.
Do we have time for one more question, or are we going to use 2 more questions?
Yeah, I'm Teddy Roosevelt came to the police commission around 1910 to do that corruption in the police department. I don't think he's too successful, but can you talk about why there was so much corruption in the police department at that time?
Well, that's your time period, so. Right, but it's not your time.
I think in general, at least I hear it as part of this general lack of regulation. You know, today we live in a very regulated, banks are regulated, corruption is regulated, we have a lot of government oversight. This was more debatable, but yes, we're supposed to anyway. This was still kind of the Wild West in terms of how things were regulated, what people could get away with. And I think too, in terms of how the NYPD was hiring, you know, earlier Roosevelt, one of the things that he did, which I gave my detective part of his history, Simon Zeal is one of the very first detectives to actually get a job at the NYPD by taking an entrance exam and doing well on a test. Before him, it was very much nepotism. Who did you know? Oh, and this of course gave people who were already on the force tons of power to get their cousins, their friends, their relatives, positions. And all of that, I think, bred both an openness to corruption, all kinds of bribery. And it took many more years until that was possible to get a little more under control.
One of the charms of New York is that one can travel not only in space but in time as well. And I was wondering, in preparing your books,
in New York City that seemed to me to be almost untouched by the change and transition from the time you were writing back then. You thought it was sort of an interesting thing to look back at.
For me, I would say certain streets in Greenwich Village. You know, you walk down the cobblestone and you see an eye. The historical plaques on the walls, and I imagine that they must look exactly the same today as they did 100 years ago. So little seems to have changed until you see the people on the streets.
I think, I mean, I set the main character's home, like in building that still exists on West End Avenue, the New Century Apartments and stuff. I've never actually been inside there. I have the floor plans and stuff. But a lot of the things from, a lot of the buildings and structures from the teens, I think still exists now. There's the Colony Club down the street, which is founded by Anne Morgan, and it was a women's only club, and that still exists now. So the teens, I think there's a little bit more, but obviously everything is always surrounded by something new. So you have this one little holdout, and then there's a lot more stuff.
It's like, it's ever so slightly trickier for me because like my book, of course, is set in 1845, right? But I do a walking tour based on the Gods of Gotham. I've done it several times. And you can start from Five Points, which is completely different now. Five Points was a notorious slum. It was up there with St. Giles in London as one of the worst slums in the world. And it was the convergence of five streets into a square that was just, you know, it was built on a swamp. It was built on top of a pond. So it was essentially a swamp, just a terrible place to be. But now it's banks, and it's the edge of Chinatown, and it's all businesses, and it looks, you know, there's a park right there, there's a playground, it's perfectly respectable. So that is completely different. But if you walk north, you can get all the way up to Mulberry Street, and you can get to old St. Patrick's Cathedral. And one of the major settings in the Gods of Gotham is actually old St. Patrick's. And of course there have been repairs done to old St. Patrick's Cathedral, but it is still there. And it is still that church. And it's kind of marvelous that you can walk all the way from Five Points up through these immigrant neighborhoods that have gone through all these changes and then get back to old St. Patrick's, and it's still there, and it was there in 1845. And I hope it'll still be there forever.
I think we probably should wrap up at this point. Do feel free to speak to the parents, eat the cookies, buy the books.